We are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Nagler. Today we have a really wonderful show for you. We'll be playing some remarks from Michael Nagler's talk at the United Nations High-Level Forum on the Culture of Peace a little later in the show. And also in the second half of the show, we'll be exploring some nonviolence in the news. But to get us started, we'll be exploring nonviolence from the scientific angle. We have a wonderful guest with us, Dr. Franz de Waal, who is an ethologist, biologist, primatologist, whose research into animal behavior around conflict resolution and empathy has really opened up a new perspective on who we are as human beings. So I'll go ahead and pass this now over to my colleague, Michael Nagler, to get us started. Have a great show, everyone.
So I would like to introduce our distinguished guest very briefly, although he has a very long and distinguished career. He was born in 's Hertogenbosch in the New Netherlands. Do I have that approximately right?
Yeah, almost.
And he is a primatologist and ethologist and is now the Charles Howard Candler Professor of Primate Behavior in Emory University. That's housed in the psychology department there in Atlanta, Georgia, and the director of Living Links Center at Yerkes National Primate Research Center. And I believe you now hold a joint appointment, do you not, with the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences at the University of Utrecht?
Yeah, I'm also a professor there, yeah.
Oh, very good. In the classics department where I taught, we call this kind of thing a split appointment, but I'm much happier calling it a joint appointment.
Okay.
Yeah. And Professor de Waal is the author of a number of books, each one better than the next, in a sense. He wrote The Age of Empathy, Peacemaking Among Primates, Chimpanzee Politics, Good Natured, which might actually be my favorite, and I think most recently, Franz, The Bonobo and the Atheist. Is that your latest work?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Good. And he has received many, many well-deserved awards, including a 2012 Nobel Prize in anatomy, and has done a popular TED Talk back in 2012 called The Moral Behavior in Animals. Wow. Well, Franz, let me ask you for starters, how was your interest piqued in what we would call the empathic side of ethology? I should say I'm classifying you as a new scientist. You know, schools like positive psychology and going all the way back down to quantum theory, there is a new spirit in science, and I think of you as one of the leading and distinguished minds in that area. So first of all, do you think that designation is correct? Do you think of yourself that way? And then secondly, how did you get interested in the reconciliation behavior and so forth?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure I'm classified as a positive psychologist because I'm actually an ethologist, which comes out of biology, and so I have a degree in biology.
I see.
And my career actually started at the opposite end, because at the time that I was a student, everything about animals, because I studied animal behavior, everything was about aggressive behavior and violence and where does it come from and what kind of aggressive instincts do we have as humans and is that similar to the aggressive instinct of other animals. And so everything was focused on aggression and competition. And also selfishness was very important. So struggle for life is all based on selfish competition, basically. And so that's the time that I grew up in as a student. And then I discovered, by sort of by accident, in the chimpanzees that I was watching, that they reconcile after fights. So it's not just that they have fights, which was the thing that I was supposed to study, but they also would come together and kiss and embrace each other. And why would they do that? I found it actually much more puzzling than the whole aggression question. And I found it more intriguing because it was an unusual question. No one was talking about that kind of behavior. And when I first mentioned it, people were sort of taken aback, like, what kind of nonsense is that? Is that they have to supposed to have a struggle for life and to compete with each other? Why would they kiss and embrace after a fight? What kind of ridiculous behavior is that? Even though humans do it all the time, of course, not necessarily the kissing and embracing part, but we have many ways of reconciling after fights. And so that topic at the time already, when I was a student, I got more interested in that side of the equation than the violence and the aggression.
Good. And I'm struck by a parallelism here from my own field, which is conflict resolution, peace, and nonviolence, that Gandhi wrote in 1909 that if we didn't have that counter-aggressive side in our makeup, we would have disappeared a long time ago because every...
Yeah, sure. The whole society cannot hold together if that's not there. You know, it is important.
I remember seeing a documentary a long time ago in the pre-Diwal phase where it was chimpanzees being observed, and they got into a fight, and the narrator said, they are angry, they're fighting. A little while later, they're kissing and making up, and at this point, the narrator said, they are exhibiting affectionate behavior. In other words, they can have negative emotions, but not positive emotions.
No, that is a thing that I've been fighting against all my life, is that we very automatically assume that bad behavior is like animals. So when humans kill each other on a massive scale, we call them animals. But good behavior, things that we like in ourselves, altruistic behavior or friendly behavior, we call that sort of noble tendencies that we invented ourselves. We pat ourselves on the back that we have that. But that behavior is also present in many animals. And so many animals have both sides. They can be nasty to each other, that's for sure. But they also, when they live in a society, they have to somehow patch things up afterwards.
Yeah. I remember getting the distinct impression when I heard you lecturing at Berkeley that you have systematically gone through all of the criteria that differentiate human from animal behavior, that signalize us as human, and shown that they're all present in primates.
Yeah, that is not just me. That is over the last 50 years, I think that's been the general trend in all the studies of animal intelligence, is that the distinctions are not really nearly as sharp as people have assumed. So people would assume, for example, that all these things that we do, all the smart things that we do, require language. And since animals don't have language, people would say, well, that means that animals cannot have that. But, you know, there's all these tendencies, planning ahead, empathy, thinking about others, what others know and don't know, all these capacities that we had assumed were uniquely human. We have now demonstrated them in well-controlled experiments, actually, and sometimes observations in the field. We've demonstrated that they exist in other species, and not just in chimpanzees or bonobos, which are our closest relatives, but also in elephants and in dogs and crows, and many species show many interesting capacities.
I really like what you have had to say about dogs. Dogs are a good example of a species that have and obey social rules. That's why we like them so much, even though they're large carnivores.
Yeah. Dogs are our best friend, and I think that is because as opposed to cats. Dogs can follow rules. I think the cats were the size of a big dog, so that makes them quite dangerous, I would say, and, yeah. and would behave the way they behave because they don't listen to us at all. I don't think we would have them in the home.
There's an allegory, a myth that I heard that when animals and humans were being put on separate mountains as they were evolving, the dogs jumped from the animal mountain to the human mountain.
Okay.
You mentioned the capacity to be aware of others' intentions and so forth. Has modern neuroscience, and particularly the discovery of mirror neurons, made an impact in your work there?
Well, mirror neurons came along in the 90s, and yeah, they were important because at that time I was starting to talk about empathy in animals, and there was a lot of resistance to it. The mirror neuron story, and the mirror neurons were discovered not in humans, they were discovered in monkeys.
That's right.
The mirror neuron story added to it in the sense that it said, well, actually, the mechanisms may be more simple than you think, and it may be just a neural mechanism that is present in many mammals. And so it supported my view in the sense that, that there's continuity with other species in that regard.
Well, it was hugely supportive for people in my field also because it showed how one person's change of mentation, one person's different intention, could bring about a change in an opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very useful for us. But I want to tease out a little bit more this concept of whether or what we have that distinguishes us as a species, and not just on the physical, biological level, of course. I know that Noam Chomsky argues that human language is very different, is qualitatively different from the kinds of signaling that animals can engage in, whether accompanied by noises or not. Are you familiar with that argument, or what do you think?
Yeah, I know that argument, and mm-hmm. I do think human language is a special capacity.
Right.
And even though we have tried to teach language to apes, that's all very limited what they do.
Uh-huh.
And so my view on language is that, yes, if you take language apart in smaller pieces, like there's a symbolic component and there's a categorization component and
right.
there's a syntactic component, if apart in pieces, you're going to find some of these pieces in other species, especially in some other large-brained species. But mm-hmm. the whole thing, the symbolic communication that we have, is not really present.
I have the book in front of me, The Bonobo and the Atheist, and In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. And when I saw this book and I found it, I just loved every single page of it. It was one of those books where I just really didn't want to put it down. And I just got really happy every time I opened it, and even now holding it in my hands. Because it's a special kind of genre for me as somebody studying nonviolence and looking at a lot of different material every day about conflict. It's almost like reading information about animal behavior and what it says about our human nature. It's almost like the cat video translated into words. It makes me feel good.
Well, the book is about the origins of morality and how, of course, we assume that morality is uniquely human, but and I think in some ways it is. But many of the tendencies that are built into human morality, which are empathy, that you are interested in others and interested in the well-being of others, a sense of fairness, a sense of social rules, all of these tendencies can be found in other species, and so I've been writing about how human morality came about. And the reason that the book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist is because many people feel religion is required for morality, that religion is the source of it,
mm-hmm.
which I don't believe. I'm not saying that religion is irrelevant. I'm not like the neo-atheists who are anti-religious. I'm not necessarily against it. But I feel human morality is much older than our current religions. And
what evidence do you have to support that claim?
Well, because our primate relatives have a lot of these tendencies that we use in human morality. And so it's very likely that when humans of, let's say, 500,000 years ago or 1,000,000 years ago, our ancestors that they had societies in which they cared about how you behaved and are you contributing to the good of the group, and they would kick you out if you didn't, and if you murder somebody, they'll kick you out or they kill you. And so they had rules, I'm sure they had rules of fairness and all these things. And so since we see that kind of behavior in chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest relatives, I assume that our ancestors had that kind of behavior and had it probably more developed already than they do. And so that's why I think that religions, mm-hmm. our current religions, are a couple of thousand years old, which is really very new, that they may have added to it. And yes, they may enhance it. That's very well possible. But they are not crucial. They're not the source of it.
Would you say that perhaps they've codified it? I'm thinking of that cave that they found in Shanidar in Iran, where someone was buried 60,000 years ago and was buried apparently with local flowers that had medicinal properties because they can find the pollens.
Yeah, that suggests a belief in the afterlife.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm sure we have a few of these unique features, and religion is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, why do we have religions? And actually, one of the theories at the moment is that the small-scale religions for these small societies, they were not particularly moralizing. Morality was not their central issue. It was more like to how to explain the world and when the rain would come and things like that. Whereas our current religions in the big societies, they have a moralizing quality. They tell you how to behave, and they tell you if you don't behave in a particular way, you'll end up in a bad place.
Yeah.
And so our current religions do try to give a narrative of how to behave and do try to justify. And mm-hmm. that's, of course, all uniquely human. My animals may have rules of how to behave and punish bad behavior and things like that, but they're not into justification of the rules. They're not into explaining to each other why they have these rules, you know?
Yes, that's right. So they can't really renegotiate the rules.
No.
So I'd like to pick up on something Stephanie mentioned before. Could you tell us some stories that you found particularly eye-opening and maybe particularly encouraging that you observed in your many years of work?
Yeah, one of the things that I find very intriguing is how high-ranking males are impartial when they settle disputes in the colony. So that looks almost like a system of justice in the sense that if my best friend beats up a female, I'm still maybe going to defend that female instead of my best friend. And so that's what we observed, in that these high-ranking males, they step into conflicts and resolve them without necessarily favoring the ones that are either related to them or are their best friends. And so they become sort of impartial. And the first time I noticed that, I was actually sort of a very small little incident, was two juveniles who were fighting over a branch. This is in a zoo, and so a branch with leaves is worth something. Of course, in the wild, it would be worth nothing, but in a zoo, it is worth something. And so they were fighting and pulling and screaming at each other, and then an older female walked over to them and stepped in, took the branch out of their hands, broke it in two, and gave each one of them a piece. So she solved the conflict in an impartial way, in the best possible way, I think. So the chimps have that capacity to see where the problem is and how to resolve that problem.
Yeah. Almost a Solomon among chimpanzees.
Yeah, sort of.
This is so interesting for me because I work in a field which used to be called third-party nonviolent intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And have different names for it now. But one of the things we discovered is that the only way that it works is that if you can demonstrate and maintain nonpartisanship.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you're partisan toward one side, you're part of the conflict, and you cannot offer services to resolve it.
For example, if male chimpanzees have a fight, it's sometimes older females who step in and bring them together. So the males have a fight. They cannot reconcile. They sit sort of staring at each other, glowering, and they don't want to embrace, or they don't want to take the first step to reconcile because that's a sign of weakness. So then sometimes older females walk over to them and drag, sometimes literally drag one of them towards the other until they groom each other and reconcile. And the interesting thing for me is always that it's the older females who do this, because a young female would only cause trouble because she may have been actually the origin of the trouble anyway. Yeah. And so young females are not a great piece to have in there. And other males can also not do it, because as soon as one male steps in and approaches one of the two, it is, because everything is political in the chimpanzee society, that is immediately seen as a friendly thing and immediately seen as a sort of coalition against the other. So a male can very hard, it's very hard for a male in these circumstances to be neutral. So an older female is the best solution. So you have all these kind of rules going on in chimpanzee society, everyone expects actually the old females to do that. And I've seen situations where younger females, if males are not reconciling, which is a very, very bad situation because it creates a lot of tension in the community, where a young female will go to an old female and wake her up and get her to go and do the thing. So the young female also realizes that she cannot do it and somebody else needs to do it. Mm.
Now, Professor DeWall, I was wondering if you could talk about your observations of death and the way that animals experience death, and what conclusions that you've drawn from animals experiencing the death of their beloved ones.
Yeah, well, many animals that have attachments, they are affected by the death of others. So it's not just elephants and chimpanzees, as people think. All the mammals have attachments. For example, females have attachment to their offspring. And so if they lose their offspring, they're going to be terribly affected by it. Mm-hmm. And so all animals that have attachments, and this also applies to birds, for example, many pair-bonded birds, they're terribly affected by the loss of somebody else. Now, the interesting thing for me is that they recognize that death is irreversible. So if, for example, a chimpanzee dies, for example, in the field, a chimpanzee may fall out of a tree and break his neck, or he may have a disease and die. Then others will approach, and sometimes they sit staring there for hours. Sometimes they try to revive the individual, jumping on, dragging him around. Sometimes they groom. But they're very affected, and in captivity, I've seen many times that for days they will not vocalize, they will not eat. So they're very affected by, it's not just the death of the offspring, it's also the death of good friends of individuals that they know. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that they have an understanding of the irreversibility and of the loss, and that there's a depression or a mourning period that goes with it.
So science is then corroborating the perspective of, say, animal rights activists that say, you know, a mother cow is upset when they take the calf away and that she's experiencing real emotions when that happens.
Yeah, what she experiences, we don't know. My assumption would be, and of course many scientists will not say that, my assumption would be that animals that are related to us, such as all the mammals, that they experience similar things under similar circumstances. That for a biologist, that's a logical assumption. That's an evolutionary assumption. If you're closely related, you're going to have similar brains and similar experiences. But of course, it's not something that we can know for sure. We can suspect that, or we can assume that, but what animals experience, we don't know. But certainly they show emotions, and so emotions can be measured, of course. You can measure heart rate, you can measure all sorts of things, facial expressions. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they show certainly emotions.
And then what about how the human being feels in relationship to that animal as well, if we're standing there and experiencing the biological expressions of distress in an animal, and does that show up in our bodies too? Does research show that?
Yeah, if you're empathic, if you're not, of course, or if you're talked into not feeling that, because there's a lot of indoctrination going on, that animals don't have feelings and things like that. But anyone who has a pet, like a dog or a cat, empathizes usually with these animals. That's actually why we have mammals in the home and not usually snakes or iguanas or animals like that, is because with mammals, it's not just that we are sensitive to their emotions and respond to them, but they are sensitive to our emotions and respond to them. And that's actually the sort of contact that we like. I'm a big lover of fish. I'm walking here right in front of my fish tank, but there's not a lot of emotional connection with my fish. So I love the fish, but there's not an emotional exchange that you can have as a mammal. Hmm.
cold fish, as we say.
Yeah.
Well, I seem to remember a story in one of your books about a monkey being born and the entire community, especially the females, gathering around the expectant mother and setting up a cry of joy and excitement when the little one came out.
Yeah, that was actually an interesting incident of empathy right there, sort of what we call in the field sometimes motor mimicry. So, the female who was getting the baby, she was standing with her legs wide apart, and she was holding her hand under her vagina, because that's where the baby would come out. And in chimpanzees, these things are much simpler than in humans because the babies are smaller when they're born, and so they come out quite easily. And so she was standing there to catch it, and there was an old female, her best friend actually, was standing next to her in exactly the same posture, holding her hands also between her legs. She didn't need to do that at all. This was pure imitation that she was doing, because she was absolutely not pregnant. So she was identifying so strongly with the mother who was giving birth that she adopted sort of the same posture automatically. And that's sometimes called motor mimicry. It has to do with mirror neurons, probably.
Yeah.
It's because you see the same posture, and so you adopt the same posture. We humans do that also. If you see someone who gets hurt, for example, you may flinch, and so that means that you physically identify with what happens to the other person.
Yeah, thank God we do that. Franz, we have to bring this to a close, and I was wondering, I'd like to ask you two questions by way of wrapping up. What for you, you've done so much work and so insightful and so well documented, what would be the main takeaways for you in two respects, that in terms of our relationship to animals and in terms of what we can learn about ourselves, our relationships to one another?
Well, I think what my work basically does is that people often think it, what it does is it elevates animals to a level to where we humans thought we are unique. And it does. It elevates their intelligence, and you think, well, they're actually smarter and more complex than we thought. But at the same time, I think it has a message for humans, because it brings humans down a little. We totally overestimate the amount of reasoning and logic that goes into our behavior. We think everything is thought out very carefully, and yes, we are very great. We are great at justifying our behavior, but we do that after the fact. And our behavior is very much guided by very similar principles that are probably much simpler than we think they are. And that's why we have intuitions about think, and why we have emotional decision making. So, for example, think about. Your decision who to marry, for example. Darwin was sort of interesting. Darwin made a whole list. We still have that list. He made a whole list of rational arguments of why he would marry that woman or why he should not marry that woman, as if it was something that he could rationally decide. He ended up deciding to marry her. But I'm convinced that his rational arguments were basically irrelevant to the whole story. But we like to think that we take our decisions rationally. And I think what my work shows is that many animals make similar decisions under similar circumstances, and it is probably all much simpler than we think.
I'm not sure it's an enhancement to say that a behavior or a capacity of ours is unique. I'm inspired by the fact that it has a heritage of millions of years of evolution behind it.
Well, that's really our only hope. If empathy with others was a rational decision, like you decide to be empathic because you think it is the best to do, if that was the process, it would be pretty hopeless, because you could be easily manipulated by some ideologue to not. And actually, some ideologues try to do that. They try to tell us not to empathize with, let's say, immigrants or something like that.
Yeah.
And so they try to talk us into that. But human nature is much stronger than that, and we sometimes just go against that. And so human empathy, being a biological characteristic, is actually a very good thing, and we should be happy with that.
Yeah, and actually, we say the same in nonviolence, that if you often do not have the time to persuade an opponent by rational arguments, mm-hmm. but by your standing there and refusing to hate that person, refusing to disrespect them, but refusing to go along with them, you can bring about some of the remarkable changes that, in fact, we've seen in history.
Mm-hmm. And Professor DeWall, what are you working on right now, and what can people look forward to from you?
I'm publishing a book in the spring on animal intelligence.
Wonderful.
So it covers not just the primates that I work with, but it covers all sorts of animals. And so I'm talking about the cognitive revolution that is taking place, because at the moment we're abandoning all these simplistic ideas about animals being just learning machines or instinct machines. Mm. There's a whole field of cognition coming up, and that's what I'm describing.
It's fascinating. That's also happening in the human realm, of course. Cognitive science, a relatively new...
Oh, yeah, but in the humans, it happened already in the 70s or something, the evolution. But now is the animals... talking about animal cognition was actually taboo until the 1980s. So it's only the last 20 years or 25 years that we're talking about it.
Yeah. Well, you were a pioneer in that way and many others. I'd like to... feedback to you a quote of yours that struck me very much, and see if maybe you have a comment on it. You wrote, "Being both more systematically brutal than chimps and more empathic than bonobos, we are by far the most bipolar ape."
Yeah, so I wrote that because I was comparing this with both chimps and bonobos, and chimps are more violent for sure than bonobos are. And I always feel that humans go much further than that. So when we are nasty, we have genocides, we torture. These are things that animals usually don't do. And so we when we're nasty, we're nastier than any species that I know. But when we're altruistic and kind, we're also kinder than almost any species that I know. And so I feel we have that whole spectrum. And people sometimes try to simplify and say, well, humans are a nasty species, but that's not entirely true, as we know. And so sometimes we try to simplify and squeeze ourselves into one hole, but we are a very complex species.
You know, I keep coming around to this idea that what we're primarily confronted with is choice. And what mm-hmm. you're saying simply raises the stakes, intensifies the choice.
Mm-hmm.
Professor DeWall, one last thing. You know, we're here in Point Reyes Station in California and recording live here in the studio. And I saw a bumper sticker out here recently that said something like, "Be more bonobo."
And
right. So.
Yeah, well, that can mean many things. It usually means sexual.
Yeah.
People want to be sexually free, and then they think that the bonobos are completely sexually free, which I doubt.
Uh-huh.
But bonobos are sexually more diverse, let's say, in what they do than many other species, and so that's probably what they mean.
Okay.
Given that this was a California bumper sticker, I think that probably was.
It might be the case.
Well, I also saw one that said, "Be the person your dog thinks you are."
That's a nice one, too. Thank you so much for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio, Professor DeWall.
Okay, thank you.
So let's turn now to nonviolence in the news with Michael Nagler. So, Michael, is there any nonviolence happening in the world these days?
Bah, hardly any.
Not much. No, what do you have for us?
I actually had quite a list of resources that I'll mention at another time, but I think the most important thing for me to cut to is some of the events coming up. Mm-hmm. And very local to our mother station here in Point Reyes station, KWMR. In San Geronimo Valley, on the 21st of this month, September, the United Nations International Day of Peace is going to be celebrated with music, art show, speakers, and, of course, the inevitable food. And KWMR will have a table there. It is also the period of time when the campaign Nonviolence is entering its second year of operation. At last count, what I saw was that there are 305 events that are going to take place around the country. Also, on a somewhat grimmer note, this is from the School of the Americas Watch. In a few days, on September 26th, we will be having the anniversary of the abduction of those 43 students from Ayotzinapa School in Iguala, Guerrero, Mexico. And so SOA Watch is asking us to join in actions that are taking place in cities across the U.S. and to demand that the U.S. stop funding the militarization that's enabling human rights violations in Mexico. Also, on the climate side, a big day is planned for next month, October 14th, and you can look up peoplesclimate.org/action/map to see where some of these events are going to take place. This is in the lead-up to the Paris climate talks. And coming up in November, there is an urgent national call to action for a mobilization in Washington, D.C. from November 14th to 18th to coincide with the Asian Pacific Economic Council meetings going on in the Philippines. And this is going to be an attempt to coordinate non-TPP actions. In fact, one of the lead-off events was in New Zealand, and their slogan was, TPP, no way, New Zealand, walk away. We've reported earlier on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so I won't go much into that now. But here's a very interesting wrinkle. You may remember that in an earlier program we talked about drone operators walking off the job. Many military personnel experience what our friend Rachel McNair calls perpetration-induced traumatic stress and suffer various arrays of symptoms from that. And it was interesting to note that drone operators, who are supposed to be immune because they don't actually see at first hand the carnage that they've created, they are nonetheless starting to resign and just walk away from their job. So there's a newspaper called the Air Force Times. It's a weekly newspaper owned by an outfit called Tegna, Inc. It has a circulation of over 65,000 and includes members of the Air Force, the Air National Guard, Pentagon officials, and members of Congress and their staffs. And they published an advertisement on September 14th with the message that 54 U.S. military veterans are urging U.S. drone operators to refuse orders to fly drone surveillance or attack missions. That's very significant because drone warfare is one of the cutting edges of some of the modern extremes of violence that Professor Dewall was just talking about, and that Mahatma Gandhi said, we have seen incredible developments in the field of violence, but I maintain we'll be seeing even more undreamt of and seemingly impossible developments in the field of nonviolence. So a number of groups are collaborating around this effort to get drone operators to step back. Iraq Veterans Against the War, No Drones, that's K-N-O-W, drones.com, Veterans for Peace, and so forth. Code Pink and Mennonite, 1040 for Peace Committee. And this ad comes at a time of increasing drone surveillance and attack missions, which are now underway in Syria, as well as Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And the ad reminds us of a very important Nuremberg principle, and I quote, "The fact that a person acted pursuant to an order of his government or of a superior does not relieve him of responsibility under international law, provided a moral choice was in fact possible. And if you're willing to make sacrifices, then moral choices are always possible." But since I've mentioned Syria, I'd like to mention that a recent article has come out with a very disturbing revelation, and that is that it particularly disturbing in connection with the fact that Bashar Assad is still in charge of his regime in Syria, is asking that we join him to fight the extremists in that country. The fact that probably he released a large number of extremist prisoners at one point in his regime when it was under attack. The logic there seems to have been that if he could radicalize the resistance movement, which unfortunately he succeeded in doing, then it would be something that he could handle. And that he was afraid, this is the part that I really wanted us to think about and I want to share with all of us, he felt that the nonviolent resistance could take him down, that he would not have the capacity to resist it. And so he actually caused it to turn violent or to be perceived as violent, more accurately, because nonviolence is still going on. And so this is something I think that we all need to think about and take into account. Well, I think I will wrap up this edition of Nonviolence in the News.
Thank you so much for the news, Michael. There is a lot going on in the world of nonviolence, but sometimes you give us the news. Every other week you give us the news, and sometimes you make the news. So the next thing we're going to do is play your remarks from the September 9th high-level forum on the culture of peace. You were in New York City at the headquarters of the United Nations talking about the role of the media in the culture of peace, and specifically from the perspective of nonviolence. How can we understand the media from a nonviolent angle? All this and more. So let's listen to Michael's remarks.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I want to take this opportunity also to thank Ambassador Chaudhry again for his vision and his energy in making this discussion possible. Like my predecessors, I'd like to start off with some stories. Three coincidences, actually. The first one goes back to December 28th, 1898. That was the day on which two very fateful things happened for our civilization. One was the discovery of atomic radiation, which was in a paper that Roentgen delivered to the Physical Society, and the other was the first time that a film was shown publicly in Paris. So, in other words, the atomic age and the age of mass communication both started on the same day. So we have two extremely powerful technologies, and I'm going to argue, because I think it's safe to do so here, I'm going to argue that the mass communication technology is more powerful even than the nuclear technology, because it is the former that actually drives the latter. If people don't hate, if they don't fear, they won't misuse that terrific power the way they've done. The second coincidence took place much more recently. 9 years ago, the world was memorializing the fifth anniversary of 9/11. That's going to happen again in 2 days. And there must have been literally billions of people who were involved in the remembrance of that tragedy. But at the same time, how many people noted that it was the 100th anniversary of the birth of Satyagraha, or nonviolence, in South Africa? September 11th, 1906 was when Gandhi gave a famous speech in the Johannesburg Empire Theater and launched what we now know as nonviolence. In fact, I wrote a little booklet about that. Lots of people holding up little blue booklets today. I wrote a little booklet called Hope or Terror to emphasize that by putting all of our attention on the terror aspect, we are only increasing it. And we are experiencing now the results of this very bad inconsistency in our attention. So things have not changed much. Last month, two Americans neutralized a would-be massacre perpetrator on a train going from, I think it was Amsterdam to Paris. And I think, again, that most of the world is aware of that. It was in all of the media. But how many people were aware that back in April, at an UN IDP camp in South Sudan, in the Boer region of South Sudan, there was an attack by a militia on the UN camp? And they penetrated the defense perimeter. And it happened that there were two internationals there, Derek Oakley and Andres Gutierrez, and they took refuge in a little hut, only to discover that there were 14 people already in there
five women and nine children who were huddling under them practically for safety, huddling in terror. Sure enough, minutes later, the militia burst in, AK-47s, axes, sharpened sticks, and they were shocked to see two internationals there, two non-Sudanese, and they ordered them out. Well, Derek and Andres glanced at one another. They've been very well trained. They knew exactly what to do. They very calmly said to these men, "I'm sorry, we are international protection officers, and we cannot leave." Well, the militia withdrew. And that was one of three episodes on that day. Now, that militia massacred 60 people in 20 minutes. But those 14 people were saved. So here you have two people. They also were well-trained. They also were extremely courageous. They say they defeated not one person, but an entire militia. And who heard about it? Practically nobody. Because, and incidentally, I had this researched by one of the staff people who's a professional journalist at the Meta Center, and there was basically zero coverage of this. I only know about it because I work with Nonviolent Peace Force. Why? Why this tremendous disparity? Because what they were doing in South Sudan was using nonviolence. They were using the right method, and we were not looking. The real tragedy here is Nonviolent Peace Force is a part of an institution called Unarmed Civilian Peacekeeping. And at the recent UN high-level independent panel on peace operations, which was released in June 16th, it was stated, unarmed strategies must be at the forefront of UN efforts to protect civilians. I would say that it is essential that strategies like this, which deploy nonviolence instead of violence, which deploy hatred instead of playing on cowardice, have to be promoted by the Security Council and the General Assembly, the highest level. I think I'm not exaggerating, at least I'm not exaggerating my own feelings, when I say that I think this is the salvation of the world, that if we're going to really get rid of the scourge of war, it will only be by recognizing that humanity has another power that it can draw upon. Now, Gandhi saw this asymmetry 106 years ago when he wrote Hind Swaraj, and in a simple statement of his, he adds a critical dimension that I'd like to cite here. He said, "Nonviolence being natural is not noted in history or in the mass media, which becomes the material of our history." And he is suggesting, and elsewhere he said it quite clearly, that somehow nonviolence lies at the core of human nature. There was a Kurdish activist in Erbil in Iraq a few months ago who said, "I'm going to use nonviolence. It takes longer, and it's more difficult, and it's more dangerous, but you do not lose your humanity in the process." He was on to something. As a matter of fact, he was wrong. Nonviolence doesn't take longer. It isn't more dangerous. Of course, it is difficult in some ways, but we now know, thanks to the study called Why Civilian Resistance Works, that nonviolence takes half the time, takes one-third the time and is more successful twice as often as violence, at least in the context of insurrections. So I'm really stressing this point about our inner human nature, which I think has to become our destiny. We all know about the war on nature, but we're not noticing a war on human nature. If you live in an industrial country like this one, you are going to be exposed to between 3,000 and 5,000 commercial messages every day. Now, I thought that's impossible. That's a gross exaggeration. I walked from 23rd Street up to 33rd Street, and I counted, and I thought, if anything, this is an understatement. And what are those commercial messages telling us about our nature? We're empty. We need to consume things from the outside world. We're basically physical entities separate from one another, doomed to live in a world of competition and violence. We have become, and we've heard it several times here today, I'm glad to say, we become sensitized to any attempt at the degradation of women, and that's very, very good. But what about the degradation of the human being? We are not paying sufficient attention to that. Now, I suppose most of us know that the world is in the throes of something called a paradigm shift. It's a shift from an old story of material reality that I was just describing. And as Martin Luther King said it, we must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented civilization to a person-oriented civilization, which to my way of thinking is a civilization aware of and founded upon nonviolence. So I'm among those who believe that this shift is absolutely essential for our survival, and seen in this light, the media are doing much more harm at a deeper level than they do by not reporting on nonviolence and reporting endlessly on violence. By if looking in the local paper, there's whole pages devoted to accidents and crime and almost nothing devoted to the better angels of human nature. But much deeper than that, the media basically, in terms of their scientific reportage, are basically reporting as though this shift were not happening, as though there only were one scientific model. Just to take one example, because we are limited in time, hardly a week goes by that the newspapers don't tell you that the scientists have just discovered the gene that makes you like Canada Dry or vote Republican or eat peanut butter. Now, no real geneticist believes that it's even remotely possible for a gene to control us in that way. But by constantly reporting in on this old story and not acknowledging the tremendous discoveries that have been made in the last 100 years in science, they are basically perpetuating the old story. So I believe that the media actually have to lead that paradigm shift. They have to change what gets reported. According to a new study that was released by Farley Dickinson University, people who watch a certain news outlet, kind of hesitant to name it here, I don't know what the libel laws are, but it's a three-letter word starting with F, ending X. People who watch that particular media outlet are actually less well-informed than people who do not watch the media at all, which is actually a strategy that I'm about to recommend. And so not only do they have to readjust that asymmetry, but they have to learn what nonviolence means and understand it well enough to report it sensitively and accurately. That's one of the things that the Meta Center is working on right now. And finally, to put it in the right framework, they have to stop speaking and writing as if that were not controversial, that we're physical objects separated from one another, doomed to competition and violence, etc. I think the huge breakthroughs in technology, the social media, could actually be of help here. 90% of the U.S. media are controlled by 6 corporations. And I think that social media could go a ways toward breaking up that monopoly. But the fact is, the technology is just the medium. We are the message. If we use social media for wrong purposes, as several of us have pointed out here, we will not be changing anything for the better. So I'm going to now, I'm very much encouraged by the passion of President Federico Mayor, and I'm going to now list very quickly a few suggestions for the fifth actor for the UN. I have no standing on which to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then some suggestions that we can follow as individuals, and then I will close. So I believe that the UN should do another white paper like the UNESCO-sponsored document of 1986 called the Declaration of Seville, which was fundamental in shifting public opinion from belief in the innate aggression theory to a saner and higher image of the human being. And we could do very much the same thing again with journalism. What if the UN were to have, now this is probably going to be my most controversial statement, what if we were to have a rating system where we rated certain media outlets in the amount of violence and vulgarity. What if the world body were to produce a briefing paper for journalists? And what if they were to give direct support to programs such as the Hollywood and Nonviolence Program that's trying to get started at UCLA, which would make storylines of nonviolence the new normal? And so now, as to what we can do while we're waiting for the world body to make these changes, my organization has come up with five suggestions. I'll make this very brief. One, I'm going to put this in the briefest form possible: boycott the commercial mass media. There, I said it, and I'm glad. This will leave a big hole, of course, in your cultural lobe of your brain. So second suggestion is you fill that vacuum by learning everything that you can about nonviolence. You'll be amazed at what a difference this makes for you. Thirdly, and of course I'm from California, so I would say this, but I want to remind you that Maria Montessori said that she was trying to develop that spiritual life upon which alone can be built up the peace of the world. So I would suggest, if you haven't already done so, explore some kind of spiritual practice. I've been doing one myself called passage meditation for decades, and the results may not seem impressive, but if you had known me 30 years ago, I think they would be. Fourthly, this will bring about wonderful changes in your personality, and what you can then do is engage yourself more personally with everybody that you interact with. And fifthly and finally, in your actions and your activities, make yourself a representative of the new story, the new image of the human being. And what is that story? Well, I want to close with just a few lines from a beloved Indian sage who visited the U.S. in 1954 for the purpose of preempting World War III. Apparently he survived, so this is a pretty powerful individual. And he said, his name was Swami Ramdas, and he said, "On the physical plane, man is but an animal. On the intellectual plane, he is a rational being. On the moral plane, he is a power for good. On the spiritual plane, he is a radiant being full of divine light, love, and bliss. Humanity's ascent from one plane to another is its natural movement." Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to our mother studio, KWMR. Thank you to Professor DeWall, and thank you to everybody at Meta and all of our listeners. Until the next time, everybody, take care of one another.